someone who is in debt and keep seeking out loans to everybody around them and keep owing people money. That's basically the economic situation in Djibouti.
Welcome back to episode 12 of Next Stop Africa. I am your gracious host, Amy Kikoma. I'm Congolese, and I am here with the man that does it all, Ludin, Dominican, Puerto Rican. Before we jump into today's episode, make sure everybody checked out our last episode on Comoros. First of all, Ramadan Mubarak to all of our Muslim brothers and sisters and all that, and all those that follow and practice the faith of Islam. This is my, 10th year participating in Ramadan. It's always a beautiful experience. Yeah, and I think with that, though, we can kind of get into today's quiz of the day. The question is, which African country has the highest monthly minimum wage? You could take a guess.
Can you give me a hint of the region? I'm just locking my answer. Just say Kenya.
No, Seychelles. I think the standing minimum wage monthly is $465. But today we're going to be talking about the Republic of Djibouti. I was speaking to a friend the other day, and she was inquiring of what episode we were doing next, and I did tell her it's Djibouti. And I feel like there's a lot of people that do not know about this country, even those that live on the continent, they do not know.
Mm-hmm.
Because she was born there. She was actually born in Kenya, actually. And she was telling me that she does not know. You know, so she was very interested. And so if you are listening, I'll do my best to make sure that once you're done listening to this episode, you know just about everything there is to know about this beautiful country.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, as always, we're going to jump into the kind of like the culture and language side of Djibouti, just to give kind of like a quick background on the country. The Republic of Djibouti is situated in the Horn of Africa, bordered by Ethiopia in the southwest, Somalia in the south, Eritrea in the north, and it's between the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden on the east. The official language are French and Arabic. However, Somali and Afar are most widely used languages. The primary religion practice is Islam, with 92% of the population belonging to Islam and 8% belonging to Christianity. The people that make up Djibouti are 60% Somali, the Issa people, 20% are Afar, 6% are Arabs, 4% are Yemenis, and the remaining 10% includes Ethiopians, Italians, and other Europeans. And then now kind of jump in a little bit, the politics history of Djibouti. Researching this one, it was definitely very in-depth. Yeah, there was a lot that was happening in this country for sure. 1862, France acquires the port of Obak. 1888, the French colony of Somaliland was established over the region. 1892, Djibouti becomes the capital of French Somaliland. 1897, Ethiopia acquires parts of Djibouti after signing a treaty with France. 1964, Djibouti made an overseas territory within the French Union. 1958, Djibouti votes to join the French community. 1967, a referendum occurs during which the Afar people and Europeans vote to remain a part of the French community. French Somaliland is renamed as the French territory of the Afars and the Issas. 1977, Djibouti becomes independent with Hassan Goulad Abditen as president. 1979, People's Progress Assembly Party was set up to unite the Afar people of Ethiopia and Eritrea background and Issa of Somali background. 1981, Djibouti becomes a one-party state with People's Progress Assembly as the sole party. 1992, a constitution allowing for a limited multi-party system is adopted. Fighting erupts between the government troops and the Afar Front for the Restoration of Unity and Democracy, FRUD, in the country's northeast region. 1999, President Abdinton announced that he would not run the presidential election. Ismail Omar was elected president in February of 2000. The government and the radical faction of Fraud signed a peace agreement, finally ending the civil war. September 2002, the 1992 law allowing only three other parties to compete with the ruling party expires, paving the way for full multi-party politics. January 2003, the Union of Presidential Majority, a coalition supporting President Ismail, wins Djibouti's first free multi-party election since independence in 1977. February of 2008, the ruling coalition won all 65 seats in the parliament elections, which was boycotted by the other three main opposition parties. December of 2009, UN Security Council approves tough sanctions against Eritrea for supplying weapons to opponents of the Somali government and refusing to resolve a border dispute with Djibouti. April of 2010, Parliament approved constitutional amendments allowing the president to run for a third term. February of 2011, thousands of people gathered for a rare protest demanding the regime to change. At least two people were killed. April of 2011, President Ismail wins a third presidential term in an election boycotted by the opposition. June to September of 2011, Djibouti was hit with the worst drought within the Horn of Africa. February of 2013, opposition groups contest parliamentary elections after their 2008 boycott. they rejected the results, which gave the governing union for presidential majority 49 of 65 seats. June of 2014, Djibouti suffers its fourth straight year of drought. UN officials said December of 2015, several people were killed in a clash with the police in the capital. Opposition accused authorities of arresting supporters. April of 2016, President Ismail gains a fourth term of office following the elections, having previously said he would not run for presidency again. June of 2017, Djibouti accuses Eritrea of sending troops into a disputed area on the border following the withdrawal of Qatari peacekeepers. And then August of 2017, China formally opens its first overseas military base in Djibouti. And then from then until now, obviously, President Ismail is still in power, which is insane to think about, but kind of get into that a little bit later. But yeah, you know, I think the political side and history side of this country is very, I wouldn't say complex, but a little confusing. But I think it's similar to what we've seen with almost, you know, every other country so far that we've looked at in the East, you know, where, you know, one party has been ruling for ages, you know, but yeah, we could get into kind of like the finance.
So I just kind of want to do a very macro kind of overview of it. And so for a lot of the finance aspects of it, the first thing that I want to talk about is that if we think about the land of Djibouti, it's about 23,200 square kilometers. And so for comparison, for those of you who live in the state, who lives in the United States, New Jersey is about 22,000 kilometers. And so it is just very shy over the size of New Jersey. And so the population of Djibouti is about 1.106 million people, while in New Jersey, it's about 9.7 million people. And so it is a little bit bigger, but it has less people. So just to kind of give your mind kind of rolling how it kind of goes with that. And so another aspect to Djibouti is that even though that is almost the same size as New Jersey, and that it has, you know, a lot of grand agricultural land, you know, they had about 73% of the total land is all pasture land, which is just essentially kind of like, you know, very like a grassland type of field. It's very susceptible to climate change. You know, like Amy said, you know, there was a drought that kind of happened. And on top of that drought that they had very little rainfall that kind of occurs. And so because they have very little rainfall that occurs, there's very low amounts of fruits and vegetables and food that is produce in order to essentially get food. And with that being said, because of that, they heavily rely on imports, where, and this is according to an article in 2017, about 42% of their imports, where it comes from machinery, equipment, food, all of that comes from China, 14% from Saudi Arabia, 4% India, 6% Indonesia, and 3% Oman. And so a lot of it is kind of tied into China, which if you haven't kind of seen kind of a lot of the conversation threads that we've had from the beginning, there's been a lot of agreements on how China is quote unquote developing and helping Africa. And so this just kind of like leads into that. Can one say that is a noble thing to do? That's all for you to interpret and see whether that is or is not. And so some of the exports that they do are like coffee, salt, Heinz, dried beans, chalk, wax, like a lot of things that, not that are not needed, but are things that like are part of one piece of the pie that's needed for the whole pie. And so like some of the exports are like Ethiopia, which has 38.8%, Somalia, 17.1%, Brazil, Yemen, and then US is about like 4.6. And so that just kind of gives you the overall land of how it is. And so it's interesting with all these different facets of hearing the food scarcity, hearing how the population is, hearing how, you know, the political climate is and the size of it. Kind of life expectancy is kind of just shy over 60. And so, which is interesting, because then essentially, you know, people are, for the lack of food, there seems to be kind of a so-so kind of life expectancy for the lack of scarcity of food. However, it means that a lot of it is really hinged upon imports, which means they're at the mercy of a lot of the imports that are being provided because of, you know, the lack of scarcity. Kind of think of it like in Hawaii. And like in Hawaii, a lot of the food that is there is heavily taxed and heavily imported because a lot of things need to get in there. And so it's kind of something similar in that kind of case, where it's kind of like not a isolated island, but kind of an island that kind of gets a lot of their food kind of imported. And so, you know, some of the things to also kind of consider when it comes to Djibouti is that, you know, the country has very few natural resources. And so, like I was mentioning, a lot of the imports are, they're at the mercy of the imports. And about like 80% of its food that the people eat there comes from imports from neighboring countries or neighboring areas around, just so that they can have access to food. And so just to kind of give a broader perspective in terms of how Djibouti works. So in terms of US dollars, the Djibouti made about like $6.6 billion in terms of the GDP. And so out of that, 77% of that came from service. And we're talking like your typical service labor type of work. So all of that is coming from people doing laborious amount of work. 15% of that is industry, You know, that can be kind of manufacturer, which there's also kind of a 4.4%. Some articles were kind of including them together, some of them weren't, but that's just kind of a little bit of the breakdown. And then 1.6% is from agriculture, which, if you hear, those are some of the exports that we have. There's not really a lot to be done. And so there's just a lot of more intensive labor and work that is done. And so out of that, people that are working, so like mentioned earlier, 1.106 million people live there. Out of that, only 244 million or 244,000 people are labored workers that are in there. And so a lot of it is done in service, where 92% of those people working are in the service works. And the rest of the percentage is either unemployed, doing industrial work, or doing agricultural work. And so it's just heavily on like on type of service works. And so I know earlier I kind of mentioned that it doesn't have a lot of resources in Djibouti. And so kind of a lot of it is just there is a potential for geothermal power. They do have gold, they do have clay, granite, limestone, marble, salt, just a lot of type of rocks and geology and geological advantages to them, but nothing that will kind of give them the upper hand. And if we know all about like, you know, minerals and like gold and diamonds and all that, we all kind of know how some of the countries kind of get that. So we don't need to really beat a dead horse like that. So this is kind of like the overall view of it. So I would love to hear some of your thoughts about it. It was very interesting to kind of see how it's almost in the same size as the land of the United States, but then kind of differs with a lot of the people, the environment, and all that.
My thoughts on what the country itself, or like,
Because, you know, I saw that you were very interested when you heard there was a good 42% of imports coming from China. You seem to be very, very happy. So like all those different facets of
happy,
facets.
happy.
Obviously, sarcastically happy.
Oh, okay,
Goodness gracious.
I mean, I can see why China has interest, right? Again, they have ports, right, by the country, right? So you figure, you know, it's kind of like the deal that they did with what was it, Kenya, right? And like all the surrounding countries in the east, where it's like we give you something, you know, to make your country look pretty, you know, but we take something that's important from you away, right? So I feel like a lot of these countries, when they do have like this higher number of imports to these, you know, more impoverished countries, you know, it doesn't make sense, right? Because clearly the people are not feeling that import, right? Because they still living in poverty, right? Like things like that, they're very simple to have in conversation, but they're very complex in practice, right? Yeah. Again, like I think, like, you know, them being located by the Red Sea, you know, and being like a bridge, I guess you could say, between Africa and the Middle East, I think that's one of like the more important things. 'Cause like I was mentioning earlier, like the US had interest, right? When they had the conflict in Afghanistan, they had interest there. China just built a military base there. So it's kind of, yeah, all these things is like very strategic. And France has a military base there. Japan has a military base there. You know what I mean? So it's like even NATO, you know? So it's like these things is, I don't know. All these people are there, but the country does not seem to be representative of, what's the words I am looking for here? Like you have all these big countries, right, that are using this land. So clearly they're paying something. No matter how small it is, they're paying something. But that something is not being felt or being trickled down, which hints to why President Ismail has been in power for 5 terms, from 1999 until now. He's been in power. That's don't know. I'm obviously not a fan.
I don't think you were ever a fan. Ever. You made that very apparent from the very get-go of the podcast. But yeah, that's kind of a lot of the economic aspects of it, where a lot of it is heavily reliant on kind of imports. And it's just like Amy mentioned, there's been a decline in kind of the governance of Djibouti. The debt keeps growing, and they just keep on relying on Ethiopia and China. I guess the best analogy is someone who is in debt and keeps seeking out loans to everybody around them and keep owing people money. That's basically the economic situation in Djibouti in a nutshell.
And I think that makes sense because, again, I was reading about how President Ismail does have close relations with China, so it makes sense to why, like, because China is growing interest in Africa and the Middle East, right? So for them, it makes perfect sense, to throw him some money, so they could kind of just do what it is that they do. But I think with that we can kind of jump in into today's topic, which is poverty. I think trying to understand the cause of the state of the country, which I think is straightforward. I think by now
Amy's like, you already know. We don't even got to explain ourselves. You heard it.
To be fair, right? Like, I think by now, if you've been listening, if you've been picking up a little bit, I think you know the answer to the question as to why a lot of these countries are in poverty. There's multiple reasons, but they all lead to one thing. But yeah, we spoke of the good president Ismail Omar. A little refresher on who he is. He became president in 1999. He was handpicked as a successor to his uncle, Hassan Abdetten. His uncle ruled Djibouti for 22 years prior to 1999, right? So from independence in 1977 up to 1999. And then just to show how crazy President Ismail's term run has been, first term was from 99 to 05. Second term was from 05 to 2011. Third term was from 2011 to 2016. Fourth was from 2016 to 2021. And then his fifth has been from 21 up to the present. I think that's insane.
That's wild.
That's pretty insane to think about. And then to also add on, basically the country has been in his family forever. Like, you know what I mean? And the assumption obviously is going to be that his successor is going to be somebody in his family, right? Like, he seems to be living lavishly. Obviously, I wouldn't expect anything else. Yeah, so this guy is clearly a dictator. I think we need to start calling a spade. He's definitely a dictator. Because again, if we're using the definition of dictatorship from the Western point of view, this is classic as it gets. I think with that though, we could jump into today's topic where we kind of look at poverty. If you did listen to Ludin before, when he was talking about the economy, you probably could put two and two together. If you listen to me rambling all the time, you definitely could put two and two together. But
Amy sounds like one of those like tinfoil hat people,
for
like, I'm
real, bro.
telling you.
Yeah, bro. I feel like that's how I feel, bro. Like a crazy uncle, bro, just like running around. But yeah, no. If you can kind of better explain to us, I guess how it is they got here. I know you touched on it a bit already, in the economy section, but.
So, like we mentioned and we talked about, a lot of it is a lot of their food is really imported. And it's just one of those things where about 42% of people living there is living in poverty. And now, like, when we're talking about like poverty, we're talking like, your atypical kind of like, people that need food, people that are malnourished, like a lot of like the lack of access to that. And so a lot of it just had to do with not to, and this is not to say that they were like doomed to become impoverished from the get-go. But it was pretty much number one, like the land is a the land itself is a very huge disadvantage, in terms of kind of like a little bit of the environment with climate change. But like then climate change is also a symptom of what has been done in terms of the amount of greenhouse gases that has been emitted from a lot of the first world countries, let's call them. And so, not to point fingers and say that it's so and so's fault, is that fault, but it's just a huge trickle of effects of everything that's kind of around. And so you have an area that the land has potential to kind of grow a lot of their foods. And so there's potential of it, but then you have the environment working against you. And then because you have the environment working against you, not being able to bring up food, then you have this kind of orchestration ordeal of now how do you get food? How do you do jobs? Like in a lot of the other countries that we talked about, agriculture was always kind of around in the 20 to 40% range of people working in it, or if not like really have hyper emphasizing it. And so because of that, in this case, this was 1.6% of the GDP came from agricultural, and from the people that was working, only about 1.19% of people that are actively working work in agriculture. All the different types of the rocks that are available, or kind of some of the resources that are there, are like that gold, clay, and granite and stuff. And so that 1.19% is just, it just paints a picture, and it's kind of always kind of painted that picture of that's kind of like the situation that it has been, and it's been a constant struggle from the get-go. So that's kind of like a very broad overview of it. But I don't know if we have like if that brings in any questions to you. And by no means, y'all, does this make me an expert? I'm not an expert. I'm just a humble individual that has done research. And so if there's anything that I've said incorrectly or anything that brings into question, you're more than welcome to always fact check us and to, make sure that we're on top of it, but as well as to always take the extra step and to do a little research yourself. I don't know if you have any questions and stuff, Amy.
No, I think first thing that we even mentioned in the last episode of Comros was the age breakdown. Because of poverty, clearly, like what is the term? The length of living? No, the length of living? No, the term of living? No,
The life expectancy?
life expectancy?
Yeah, the life expectancy is 60, which isn't far off because of the United States, the life expectancy is also 65. I think it's around 60. Well, not 60. Hold on. I need to look it up. Stay, bear with me.
Right. But there's about 30% of the people and Djibouti are under 15, right? 26 is about 15 to 29. 22% is 30 to 44, you know, and that decreases as you go. Did you find it?
So the life expectancy in the United States is 77 years. And the closest that it gets to 60 for in the United States is, well, and this kind of current graph that I see was in 1960, which was 69. So the people in 1960 were living far better off than the people of Djibouti have lived.
Now,
And so,
yeah, which again, I think that's it's actually crazy, but when you think about the land itself, Djibouti does have harsh landscape, so I think that also plays right a role in like why a lot of this stuff is imported.
Yeah, it's just the land is not in his favor, and it's like one of those things that you have to be kind of creative with the solutions, kind of like places like in Venice, where a lot of their infrastructure is all like man-made kind of wood and support and foundation, which is a whole different case in point because they're facing flooding, like there's no tomorrow. But you know, that's just because like that's a man-made solution and like it's all like, you know. It's all like it's gonna expire one way or another. Materials kind of decay. You know, we've you know all like common things that kind of happen. Like nothing is there like for forever, and nothing, even though it's foundational, it's still gonna have to like it's still gonna decay over time.
And I did read somewhere that that there's potential for like geothermal energy in the country. All these things, right? Maybe like because I mean they don't have a lot of natural resources to begin with, right? But I think when you find something, right, that you can kind of help the country out with, I think you should put your all into it,
What you
right?
mean?
If
What
there's
you talking about?
potential for geothermal energy, right? I think.
Well, geothermal energy, like the whole aspect of it's difficult. It's even like even though the US, and this is not to excuse it, but like even though in the US, like geothermal energy it is expensive because essentially the concept of it, and I think you're familiar with it, Amy, right? Yeah. For those of you who aren't familiar with it, geothermal energy is essentially the transfer of heat through using the ground. And so at a certain point, how deep the ground is, there comes to a point where the ground temperature what we see on the surface is much different than like 20, 30 feet under. And so like the most there's like different styles of it, but the most typical standard style, and you can correct me, Amy, if I'm wrong, is essentially kind of like taking some of these like tubes that kind of go into the ground, maybe about like 20, 30 feet under, and kind of like move around at 90 degree angles, like all around, and then shoot back up. And so like you have a, you know, let's talk about for water, for example, you have a water that is sitting at 90 degrees Fahrenheit, let's say. You go down into the tube, kicking all around, go all the way down into that 30 feet into the ground. And that change of temperature, because the concept of heat is that it is never created or destroyed, but transferred. And so cold, or essentially, which is essentially the lack of heat, will get kind of transferred out and kind of moved around. And so as that hotter temperature is going downward, that temperature is being transferred out into the colder soil, and which pays attention to the laws of thermodynamics, which I won't bore you because that class scared me. And so essentially the hot air goes to cold, and it's just kind of like this cycle of like, you know, hot to cold to hot, all that kind of stuff. And so all that kind of comes out. So by the time it shoots out the other end, it becomes whatever desired temperature that you do. But it's expensive. It's really expensive to do that. And so how do you do that if you don't even have the money for it? You know what I mean?
But that's the thing. That's the thing.
Oh, okay. Go ahead, Mr. Tacoma.
That's the thing, right? I think the government has the money right? But I think the way the money is distributed, as we've seen with every government on the continent right now, right? With the exception of Burkina Faso and the three group out there. But the way the funds are distributed is just between, those political leaders, right? So there's no actual reinvesting in the country, right? So the money is there, right? But the money is not being used, for anything else, right? Like, which makes no sense, because like you could take a look at like South Africa, for example, right? They have this thing called load shedding, where they lose electricity for like a couple hours or so, right? Which makes no sense, right? Because the government has the money to fix that, right? But it's kind of like, should I fix that or should I just pocket the money, right? Like, you know what I mean? So I think that's what it is, and I think that's where my question came from, because it was like, if you have the potential to, solve something, because already right now I think a lot of stuff is generated from like fossil fuel. I think that's what I read somewhere.
Like, what do you mean? Like in Djibouti?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, that gets into a whole different array of the lack of access of like sustainability and the lack of all that within like underrepresented groups and third world developing countries and how what's up?
No, go ahead, finish it though. Finish it though. Finish
I
it.
was just gonna say like it's kind of like the equivalent of like people are like oh like people who like kind of like Loki grew up poor like I'm like I wasn't poor but I didn't grow up with like money I was kind of like I made it just I barely met ends meet but it was like five of us living in one apartment so like obviously like if you have five people working like you're gonna kind of be okay but like it's like how people in like in the ghetto or in the hood how like they're like oh like they're overweight or they're this or they're that but they don't have access to good food or food that is healthy and organic, not the organic like type of food, but like just food that is good for your body because it's more expensive. And what's cheaper? Junk food. What's cheaper? All the food that you find in the corner store and stuff like that. McDonald's, the dollar menu, all this kind of stuff. Not to say that it's their fault, but that's what is accessible. And so if you paint that picture in the same way in terms of sustainability, it's cheaper to use fossil fuel. But in the process, you're hurting the environment and hurting those around you. It's like smoking. Like, yeah, is your pleasure, but that smoking is kind of giving secondhand smoke to other people around. And it's like there's not a conversation that's about that. And it's kind of low-key frustrating because it's like just like how people, and I remember just kind of like growing up, like people have access to that food. And you're like, well, I don't have that kind of money to buy that nice avocado or that nice banana, I don't have the money. I have to like sometimes we just had to buy like some chicken and some this and some that and like some food that like that was probably like really not good. Not to say chicken's not good for you, but just I'm just giving an example. And like, maybe we had to like buy McDonald's because we had like maybe like $5 in the bank account and like that's all that we had. And so it's like in that same boat, it's like it's frustrating because that sustainability is so important and that aspect for like solar panels. I just think that the continent of Africa probably has the highest index for the potential of solar panels. And I stand by this statement. I swear solar panels can probably power, and this is just me coming up with a number, but I really think this, like 80% of the power for Africa because of how much high the solar index is for Africa. But is it done? No. But has solar panels become not cheap, but viable? Absolutely. Is it being adopted? Absolutely not. That's my rant. I'm sorry. That got me tight.
but that's I think that's my point though, right? We could speak in general, right? But this definitely applies to Djibouti as well, right? Like governments, they have access to these things, right? They have the funds. It's there, right?
Because I just feel like that's always a slippery slope though.
What do you mean? Like they don't have it?
I mean, yeah, like I feel like in some of these countries that we spoke about, yeah. But then like, what if they really don't? What if they're like in the case of, I think it was Kenya, that they took out a loan for all the people just to do all these kind of like, what was it? The construction that was kind of going on around over there from China for some of the stuff. I could be wrong. I can't quite remember, but it was like, they were talking about how, hey, like the guest we had was saying, hey, like everybody that's born, if somebody's born today, like that baby has loans, like hundreds of thousands of loans against them. And so that's like, what if it's something, not to say that it's that exactly, but like, what if it's something like that? Like there's no money. So now they're taking on loans on behalf of the people. You know what I mean? Like at that point, like, do you even have the money and the funds to do anything? Do you know what I'm trying to get at?
No, I follow. But I think if all these people in this political party can travel freely to Europe, to the United States, right? Like, I'll give an example of something that I saw firsthand. I finished DJing this event, and me and my manager were leaving. We left the building. Actually, no, I'm packing up. Another DJ's coming in. She tells me that they're doing a Congolese Independence Day event, right? Which shocked me both and my manager, right? Because I'm like, I did not hear about this. And not saying like I have to hear about it, but I'm like nobody that I know, no Congolese person that I knew about this event that was happening. So obviously I was curious as to why it seemed like very secretive a little bit. So my manager, he's a talker. He inquired, he spoke to the people, and we got in contact with the person that was organizing the event. This Congolese guy from DC, met his mom, and come to find out, this was like an invite only thing for, you know, the Congolese people in the UN, right? So them and their
family. Interesting.
That follow me, right? So I'm like, because you know my feelings towards like
we've made it very apparent since the beginning.
Yeah, my feelings towards this group, right? Very useless, but that's besides the point. We'll get into that as well. But yeah, so he told me this. He started laughing because he knows, right? He started laughing because he knows how I feel. So I was like, huh, that's interesting. So cool. So I'm like, all right, cool. We get on the elevator, we go downstairs, we're leaving. And I've never seen so many luxury vehicles in one spot in my life, right? Aside from like Miami, but they didn't own that. They did not own those cars down there. All Congolese people that work for the government, right? And bro, luxury cars lined up, going to park, walking, three-piece suits, like, and Congolese people love to dress. So I know there's nothing that they're wearing that is fake. I know if there's one thing I know is that when they dress, there's nothing that's on them that's fake, head to toe. And I'm like, bro, this is sick. This is sick, right? This is very sick because you think about like where the country is right now, right? How the country is struggling right now, right? And then you look at these people that are in power, right? How they're living here. Luxury vehicles, invite only Congolese events. You know, you'd think at least like let's try to invite all the Congolese across the states. You know what I mean? Like try to do something, you know, but it was like very hush hush. Like I just accidentally stumbled on it because I was doing an event before their event. And I was just blown away, bro, by these cars. And I'm like, bro, it's very insane to me, right? And I say that to say, you know, to kind of like answer your question, the money is never gone. The money is never gone because there's somebody in the West that is interested in the country, whether it be the French, whether it be, you know, the Chinese, whether it be the Americans, there's somebody that's going to pay you to look the other way. And there's no way, right, that this government is not making millions off of being a bridge between, you know, Africa and the Middle East, having access to the Red Sea. Because you look at now, remember when Yemen was like blocking ships in the Red Sea. You think about stuff like that. So it's very, very important. Very, very important. That access right there. So that's why I'm like, there's no way. I completely understand what you're saying. And I think who told us this? What country was this that said that they had loans even as babies?
That's what I was talking about, from Kenya.
Oh, it was Kenya. No, I was trying to remember. I was trying to remember the country. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so it's completely possible. You know what I mean? But what I'm saying is like, these people, when you dangle dollars in front of them, bro.
I mean, if people are desperate and they're trying to get out of a situation, like, but you know, these
people, they're in power already. There's no desperation of getting out of anywhere, right? Like, and
once you have that, you don't want to let go of that. You hold on tightly.
That's the sickness part of it, right? That's the sickness part of it, because you know you have people like that, and you know, Congolese people are very religious, right? They're very, very religious. And that's another thing that I always try to be conscious of. How can you hold God so close and dear to your heart, but do what you do on a daily basis and be okay with it? There is no way, as a decent human being, bro, that you can hold God close to you like that and just be okay. You're in a spot where you can, where you can actually like help, you know what I mean? And I think that's something that bothers me to the core, right? Like, yeah, I get mad at the UN, right? But obviously I feel like a lot of the anger and disappointment comes from the people themselves. You guys are allowing this to happen to the rest of the country. You know what I mean? Like, it's because somebody must have given them access, right? Like somebody opened the door. That person that opened the door, that's who I feel like I'm truly am like upset with, like disappointed in. So I think that's the issue. That's always been my issue. I don't know. Obviously not everybody is, you know, there's always going to be yin and yang in life, right? That's just how life works. That's how life balances out. There's criminals, there's cops, right? There's the sick, there's doctors, right? Like, that's just how life balances out, sadly, you know? But, you know, I think with certain things, though, I think, especially if you're that religious, right? As Congolese people are, they're very religious. And I could say Africans in general are very, they're very, very religious, right? Whether it be Christianity, Catholics, or, you know, Muslims, they're very, very, you know what I mean? So, I don't know. Yeah, things like that, you know. I started to think, like, bro, like, this is insane to me, right? Because, again, this president, like, you know, he travels and lives, like, he has access to funds, you know what I mean? And majority of them, you know what they do? They open up, like, you know, Swiss banks, stuff like that. So they put money away. Like, either way, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, it is one of those frustrating situations. And I mean, yeah, I think you and I can both agree that we share the same sentiment on that, where it's like, you know, we just want people to do the good, but you know, there's your yin and yang, your cop and your criminal kind of ordeal. And so, yeah, as y'all heard, it is a very layered, complex, nuanced, complicated situation. And so,
They do have a lot of fishes though over there. Tuna.
well, yeah, I mean, yeah, but like they also have to have access to that. So like if China is assuming China is taking control of their ports, because I haven't seen anything about that. But I can only assume about that, since if they're doing a lot of the imports and then China's going in and helping them, one can only assume. But they haven't, I haven't said it, I haven't read anything about that. But like, you know, who's to say that they even can even have access to their own, to like to the Red Sea, which, and like anybody who has access to the Red Sea, like how Amy was saying earlier, it's like that's, you hit the cream on top. You got it. You have it. And so it's like you hear this and you're like, but like people have fought in wars just to have ports like in the Red Sea and in that specific land. And like that's like that like middle ground between like Africa, the Middle East, and like I think the bottom portion of not Europe, is it? Is it Asia? I could be wrong.
Yeah, that whole like what the end
Yeah.
I'm talking about that,
Yeah, in the in between lands and around it. It's kind of like a little bit of all those. And so essentially it is a not a small body of water, but it is a body of water that is connected with so many different lands around that it is the most optimal for trade. And so because of which people have like fought and stuff like that. So this is like you got like S tier character. You got everything that anyone could have possibly ever wanted. But even though you got everything that everybody could have possibly ever wanted, you are still in poverty. I think I'm gonna just leave it there.
Right. And I think that's something crazy to think about. But yeah, no, change is coming. May not be today, may not be tomorrow, but you know, it's coming. And you know, I think like what's happening over there, you know, in the cool belt of Africa, the Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, you know, them kind of pushing for more free and liberated, you know, country of their respective countries and them joining forces, you know, I think that's going to trickle down. I think, you know, people are going to see their success and people are going to follow suit. So change is coming to Djibouti. That's for sure. Just need some patience. Which obviously is easier said than done, right? Especially, you know, from this side of the world, you know, me saying something like that, you know. But you know, we pray about it, and we, you know, and it will come to fruition. But yeah, I think that's all I had for today. I don't know if you wanted to add anything else.
No, I think you hit the nail on the head.
But yeah, I think this was a good episode. Kind of focused on a little bit on the president and his dictatorship ways. Talked a lot about the economy, you know, what shaped the country to be where it's at today. We looked at a little bit life expectancy, talked about, you know, China, France, the US, you know, and their presence in Djibouti as well. But yeah, you could
Feel free to check. Check out our podcast, Next Stop Africa, on Spotify, Apple Music, and also Google Podcasts. We also have a website called nextstopafrica.net. If you want to follow us on our social media, that's going to be _ Next Stop Africa at Twitter. And then for Instagram, it's going to be official _ Next Stop Africa. And then we also have a LinkedIn where we do a lot of our more professional kind of posts out there at Next Stop Africa. And so feel free to check us out on all those platforms. And then whenever you have any kind of inquiries or want to be on the show for Next Stop Africa, just email us at nextstopafrica7@gmail.com.
I think Luna forgot the most important things. Make sure you give us 5 stars, nothing less. If it's less than 5, you can keep it. We don't want it. And now for my favorite part of each episode, Song of the Day. Song of the Day is coming from Nigeria. Artist is Rema. Title is Calm Down. But yeah, make sure you tune in to our next episode on Eritrea. As always, though, until next time, peace.
Peace.